This is Brent Musburger, and here is your VSiN Action Update. Now, here are the latest lines from my guys in the desert.
PGA Tour playing week two at the Muirfield Golf Club. It's the Memorial. Justin Thomas, who lost at a playoff to Colin Morikawa Sunday, is a 9-1 favorite. Rory McIlroy, 12-1. Defending champion Patrick Cantlay, 16-1. Dustin Johnson and John Rahm, 18-1. Morikawa, 20-1, as is Xander Schauffele and Webb Simpson. Tiger Woods returns to the PGA Tour. He's 25-1. Brooks Koepka, 30-1. The Big Ten of the Pac-12 have announced they will play conference-only schedules in 2020. College football insider for the stadium, Brent McMurphy, on Follow the Money with Mitch Moss and Paulie Howard, says conferences eliminating non-conference games creates a scheduling nightmare.
The issue is there's four SEC, ACC, and state rivals: South Carolina, Clemson, Florida, Florida State, Georgia Tech, and Kentucky, Louisville. So if you went to a conference-only format for those leagues, you wouldn't be able to play those games. And some people, very rightly, are questioning, why would you cancel a Florida-Florida State game that you could drive 2 hours in a bus in to have Florida travel to play Texas A&M, or for Florida State to travel to play Boston College or Syracuse just because they're in the same conference? So that's what the ACC and SEC ADs and commissioners are trying to figure out, a way to keep these rivalry games. But if you do that, then you've also got to find non-conference games for the remainder of your conference members. And again, remember, Notre Dame is under the umbrella of the ACC. John Swofford, their commissioner, told me that if there was a conference-only format, he told me last month that, yeah, they would give Notre Dame as many games as they needed to fill out their schedule. So you can't simply have the ACC, SEC have a football challenge like you do in basketball, the 14 members, because you've got Notre Dame as a 15th member, and that makes it uneven. So that's kind of what they're trying to figure out. But certainly the ADs from all eight of those SEC, ACC schools desperately want that those rivalries to continue this year. But how do you do that and make the schedule even is one of the challenges they're trying to figure out right now.
The Stadium College Football Insider, Brent McMurphy, on Follow the Money with Mitch Moss and Paulie Howard. McMurphy is not overly optimistic that the season will happen. NASCAR Cup Series this week, Bristol Motor Speedway, the All-Star Open on Wednesday, Clint Bowyer 4-1, William Byron plus 550, Eric Almirola 6-1, Christopher Bell plus 650, Tyler Reddick 7-1. And the All-Star race at the Bristol Motor Speedway, Kevin Harvick the favorite plus 450, Chase Elliott 5-1, Denny Hamlin plus 550, Kyle Busch 7-1. After the All-Star festivities at Thunder Valley, the series headed to the O'Reilly Auto Parts 500 Sunday at the Texas Motor Speedway. Formula One, the Hungarian Grand Prix, Lewis Hamilton laying $1.48 as the favorite. Valtteri Bottas plus 300, Max Verstappen plus 350. Make a risk-free bet on VSiN with the VSiN Plus free subscription from now until 7 days after a major sport returns. Get Point Spread Weekly, VSiN's digital magazine, 24/7 live video stream of VSiN programs and replays, and much, much more. For details on the VSiN Plus free subscription, go to VSiN.com. With your action update, I'm Mike Sennett.
Get the latest VSiN odds at VSIN.com. And remember, cash and tickets is what it's all about.
Check out the VSiN store for the latest and greatest in sports betting fashion. We have more than 40 shirt designs, including our most popular one. Cash and tickets is what it's all about. Then there's the latest addition to the VSiN store, the Bookmaker Blonde collection of shirts and hats. You'll find VSiN shirts and hats for any occasion, and they're all made to order, so you can find the right design, color, and size perfect just for you. Are you recovering from a bad beat? We have a shirt to make you look better than you feel. Burned by some late scoring? Maybe you should wear this shirt as a reminder. It's not under until it's over. And if you're a fan of a particular VSiN show, we have a shirt for you too. You'll find VSiN hats and even VSiN coffee mugs all in our online store. Just go to VSiN.com/store and order now. That's VSiN.com/store. Best of all, it's open 24/7, so you can shop whenever you feel like shopping. Just head to VSiN.com/store. That's VSiN.com/store.
This is The Edge with your hosts, Jonathan Von Tobel.
All right, welcome in. It is The Edge here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. Little change of scenery. I am your host, Jonathan Von Tobel. But despite the fact that the scenery has changed, the content remains the same. And a great show on tap for today. We continue our National Football League team previews. Los Angeles Rams are up on deck. I think a fascinating team and a lot revolving around that offense. A lot of people are going to focus on Jared Goff, which they rightfully should, but there's another aspect of that unit, which is vitally important for the Rams' success, which we'll talk about. And maybe they did something to address the position, but maybe it's not going to be enough. And then, of course, at the bottom of the hour, Wes Reynolds is going to join us. It is Tuesday, which means it's our weekly golf spot with the guys from Long Shots. Wes is going to be with us. He's already got a few plays up, of course, up on Twitter. You can follow him there at WesReynolds1. We'll take a look at the Memorial from Wes's perspective. It is a fascinating tournament for many reasons. One, Tiger's back, so that's always fun. But two, the second consecutive week over at Dublin, there's going to be some changes on the course. But what are those changes, at least, and what the effect will be, I should say, on the field? Wes is going to join us to talk about that. And that's what I wanted to dive into, to give you our perspective on what's going to happen this weekend, excuse me, with the Memorial and what we're going to see and what the changes could be. So for the second consecutive week, as I said, we're going to be in Dublin, Ohio. Changes, of course, pin placements, tee boxes, rough length, green speeds. But a reminder that at the actual Memorial Tournament last year, Patrick Cantlay was your winner, won with a 19 under score. Funny, because that was the score that Colin Morikawa and Justin Thomas had going into their playoff this past weekend, after shooting a 64 8 under on Sunday. So let's focus on the changes, right? Because this is what you want to dive into and what we're going to see this weekend. What is so different, right? The course is the same. So how can this be that much different? Do you want to automatically look at guys who had success last week? So first off, we start with the greens, because this is, I think, obviously to me and a lot of, I would think, handicappers, the most important aspect of what this tournament is going to be from a different standpoint is what they're doing with the greens over in Dublin. For the Workday Charity Open, greens ran about an 11 on what's called the stimp meter. This weekend, it's expected to be in the range of 14. It's a lot quicker, and added essentially 2 feet on the greens here for a lot of these golfers, which is going to be massive. The reads that you had on these greens over the weekend essentially out of here, because they're going to be that much quicker. Faster greens do mean that certain holes aren't going to be available, hole locations. So theoretically, the hole locations would be easier and more accessible, but with the added fact that the greens are quicker, it's going to mean a lot of these golfers don't, of course, have the exact same read on a lot of these greens, and with different hole placements, it is going to add to the challenge, despite the fact that the holes are maybe a little bit more accessible. And then, of course, the rough is going to be a little bit longer as well. Last week, rough measured about 3.5 inches. This week, reportedly expected to grow in the range of about 4, maybe even 4.5 inches in that range. So those are the changes. Let's talk about the field. The field is absolutely loaded. The top four golfers in the world golf rankings are all going to be there. And I think, because we talked about this last week, right? We had our horses for courses, but this course did not play the same as it had with Memorials in years past. So maybe those numbers were a little off. Now, a couple of the guys that we have in the horses for courses list did relatively well. A guy like Rory Sabatini, who's actually back on this list again, did really well. Finished tied for 21st, I believe, over the weekend. Or was it tied for 17th? Tied for 17th and 9 under. But we have some new names on the list because new golfers are now part of the field, namely Tiger Woods, who's on our list for horses for courses. So let's throw this up and we'll go one by one on each one of these golfers, what their form is, what they did if they played over the weekend, and what they're looking at in terms of course history. So as you see here, these are your horses for the course. Matt Kuchar at the top, 50 rounds played here over in Dublin, a true strokes gained of plus 2.6. Remember, it was actually 2.7 last week. But he shot a 4 under 284 at the Workday Charity Open. He finished tied for 39th. His driving accuracy was really poor over the weekend. It was 66.1. Shouldn't say really poor, but you want to be higher than that. What was really poor and what really held him back was his greens and regulation. He found the fairway at a 66.1% clip, but his greens and regulation was just 59.7, and the putter wasn't great either. 1.744 for Matt Kuchar in terms of his putts per green and regulation. Overall, though, he's played Memorial 14 times. He's made 12 cuts. He's got 10 top 25, 7 top 10s, and a second place. He won it back in 2013. He missed the cut in his last appearance, but his three appearances prior, right, you had 13, 4, and 4. But all of this together, I don't like what he did over the weekend. The recent form really isn't that great either. I mean, and I'm talking about this year. I mean, you just look at right when they came back from the hiatus for Kuchar, he finished tied for 41 at the RBC Heritage, and he missed the cut at the Charles Schwab. So while Kuchar has pretty good course history here, to me, recent form, what he did here over the weekend, it kind of takes him off the list for me. But still sitting in the range of 60-1 for a guy who has some of the best true strokes gained at a course that he's played quite a few rounds at. Now let's get to Tiger Woods. Tiger is going to be fascinating because Tiger, of course, has been a guy that has a really extensive course history here, 40 rounds played, but he hasn't played. So he hasn't played a tour event since the Genesis that he finished 68th in there. We did watch him play the match, right? It was Phil and him and Tiger Woods and Peyton Manning. And I'm not sure how much you qualify that as actually playing. He did play golf, and I'm sure he's played golf in these weeks leading up, just competitive golf. Those are the last few times we saw, but the history here is great. Last year, he finished in ninth at 9 under here. He missed the cut he's made the cut in all 17 appearances at the Memorial. Tiger has, he's finished in the top 25, 13 times. He's got nine top tens, and he's won the event five times in his career, 2012, 2009, 2001, 2000, and then back to 1999. So I think the question is, does the rust offset the fact that Tiger has phenomenal course history here? And he's done it before. I think I'll look up the name of the tournament. Back in October, he took a really long time off and went to a tournament in October, played extremely well. And so does the rust hold him back in terms of winning this? I still think it's definitely within the cards if you want to play Tiger within the top 20, something of that nature, maybe playing some matchups against some guys that you'd like to fade. But I feel like the rust and the fact that he hasn't played a long time is what keeps him from actually winning the event, but he'll still be extremely competitive, maybe within shooting distance on a Sunday. Another guy on the list here, as we look again, and you can see some of the props for Tiger Woods, and we'll get some of the props, maybe not today with Wes, but a little bit more on tomorrow as well, because you know that every single operator is going to be up to their eyeballs in Tiger money, whether it's propositions or tickets on Tiger to win the event. Regardless, next up is Justin Rose, though. Justin Rose is a guy that initially, when I thought I saw this tournament, I was going to play him. And then the more you kind of read into things what happened with Justin Rose, not only this past week and how he's been performing, I feel like maybe I'm a little off here, but he failed to make the cut last week. He shot a 154 in two rounds last week on Thursday and Friday. Couldn't find the fairway consistently. Driving accuracy was 64.3%. He couldn't find the greens in regulation. His GIR was awful, just 47.2%. And once he got there, Rose's putter was awful, 1.882 in terms of the putts per greens in regulation. Justin Rose usually, at least my observations, is that the putter can get really hot or really cold for Justin Rose. And when the putter is hot, he can sink almost anything. But when it's not going for him, you see something like that in terms of the 1.882 putts per green in regulation. And then we talk about the recent form, right? We just went over what happened at the Workday Charity Open. Second consecutive missed cut for him, by the way. He missed the cut at Travelers. Prior to that, in the two events, it's interesting because the two events right after the hiatus, he finished tied for third at the Charles Schwab and then tied for 14th at RBC Heritage. But you finish that or you follow that up with two missed cuts, and it kind of takes me off of the Justin Rose bandwagon. Now, overall course history here is really solid. 10 to 13 in terms of making the cut at this event. His last three appearances have been awesome. 13, sixth, and second place finishes in his last 3 years here. And overall, nine top 25 finishes, seven top 10s, and a second place with a win that was back in 2010. But let's get to my guy, Rory Sabatini. I did bet him at 125-1. Sabatini's been playing pretty good golf lately, man. Like we mentioned, tied for 17th at 9 under just this past weekend. He had some trouble finding the fairways, right? A little troublesome off the tee, 57.1%. And that's what really held him back, along with the greens in regulation. The greens in regulation at 56.9 for Rory Sabatini over the weekend in Dublin. Not very good. And he still finished tied for 17th. But the reason why he tied for 17th, his putter was on it over the weekend. He finally made it to the greens. He ranked second in the tournament in putts per green in regulation. So the putter was on. He just couldn't get to the green in regulation. He couldn't get there in a timely fashion, and that's what really held him back. But he, again, still finished tied for 17th. Now, bringing it back to the conversation at the top, when we talk about the greens and the fact that Rory Sabatini really did read these greens pretty well from what you can see in the numbers, is he somebody who I want to bet on, right? Because he had such success over the weekend, or is he going to falter a little bit because he had such success reading these greens and faster greens are going to throw him off? To me, It might be a negative there, but his recent form and course history are enough to let me take a stab at 125-1. The two events before, or excuse me, right after the hiatus, if you look at what he did at the Schwab, he was tied for 14th. He finished tied for 21st at the RBC Heritage. He did get cut at the Rocket Mortgage Classic, but then again finished that up with his tied 17th over at the Charity. And the course history overall, 10 for 12 for Rory Sabatini in terms of making the cut, six top 25s and a second place finish. Now, his last four appearances here, if you're talking about just the Memorial, right? They've been all right. They haven't been great. I would say they're about average. 27th, 44th, 24th, and then cut 4 years ago. But again, the recent form, the numbers, remember last year too, or last year, last weekend, he was 300-1 to win what we just watched over the weekend at Dublin and finished tied for 17th. So now you're seeing the adjustment in the odds at 125-1, but still think 125-1 is a little too long in a guy like Sabatini, the way he's been playing and the course history here. All right, two more golfers to get to. Another Rory McIlroy, not as strong here. A lot goes into it. One, the odds at 14-1. Two, the course history is there, but it's over a shorter sample size of 28 rounds. But McIlroy comes in having not played since the Travelers. That was, what, 2 weeks ago. And prior to the break, he had played all right, but he finished tied for 32nd at the Schwab, tied for 41st at Heritage. And it's funny because I was going over his numbers today, and my recollection of Rory McIlroy since the hiatus was he had been playing very good golf, but the results obviously weren't there, and he had some slow Sundays as well. But he kind of put it together and, of course, had a tied for 11th at the Travelers. Course history is not really as strong as I kind of mentioned here. Overall, 6 of 8 in made cuts, 5 top 25s, 4 top 10s. But he missed the cut last year here at the Memorial, but did post 8th and 4th place finishes prior to that. So the course history is just not as deep for me for a guy like Rory McIlroy. And as we talked about with Matt Youmans last week when we talked about this course overall, the one thing that stays true, despite the fact that the course changes a little bit, you have to have some strong iron play. And a guy like Rory who just wants to rip it off of the tee, I want to see a little bit more in terms of the approach game. Then I'm going to invest in him at about 14-1 to win a tournament like this, especially when the field is as talented as it is. So that one. And then the other one I added today on the menu, at least in terms of bets that I have already made, Ricky Fowler. Ricky Fowler over 38 rounds here, plus 1.77 true strokes gained, sitting at about 40-1. These numbers I'm listing you, by the way, in terms of the odds, courtesy of the Westgate, should note. Last weekend, tied for 22nd, finished 8 under par. His iron play wasn't great, despite finding, like, check this out. Ricky Fowler found 73.2% of his fairways, but he only hit 62.5% of greens in regulation. That's not what you want. If you're able to find the fairway, you should be able to set yourself up approach-wise to get onto the green in regulation. Fowler wasn't able to do that. And it's really the only part of his game that struggled over the weekend. He finished tied for 7th in driving accuracy out of the entire tournament. He finished tied for 14th in putts per green in regulation for the entire tournament, 1.644. So he really performed well on the course. The only thing that held him back was the irons. Recent form has improved. In the two events after returning from the hiatus, he missed the cut at the Schwab and Heritage, but finished tied for 12th and then tied for 22nd in his last two events. So he's playing a little bit better. His stats last week were relatively good, and I'm getting him in at 40-1 is what I bet him at. Again, these numbers over at Westgate, I bet him 40-1 over at William Hill. But his last three appearances here as well have been really solid for him. 14th, 8th, and 2nd. And if you want the overall course history for Fowler, 7 to 10 in made cuts, 5 top 25s, 3 top 10s with 2 second place finishes. So that's the horses for courses that we've broken down. We're going to get Wes's opinions on that. But out of the out of all of these guys that I've mentioned that I do have bets on up to this point, Ricky Fowler at 40-1, Rory Sabatini at 125-1. Those are the guys that I have right now. I'll probably add, actually, I do have added a few more, and we'll get to the details on those tomorrow when I give out all of them and the thought process and going into that. But for the most part, my stats that I'm looking at are greens and regulation and approach, right? Strokes gained, approach around the green, things like that. I want guys who are able to consistently work with their irons. And I think it's something that's going to be a strength when you look at this course overall. I'm really fascinated too, what it's going to look like where the guys at the top of this course and what they were doing extremely well over the weekend, how much of a drop off, if anything, if there is, and what's going to look like. Like we talked about right on Monday, Colin Morikawa and Justin Thomas went absolutely nuts on this course over the weekend. They looked absolutely fantastic. We mentioned on Sunday that Morikawa had hit two pins on his final round on Sunday. He was absolutely on fire. We mentioned the fact that through the, what is it? Was it eight holes that Justin Thomas at one point had played them seven under on Sunday? He had been performing very well. So how much does extended rough, how much does moved pin placement, how much does faster greens change the way these guys were playing? Because to me, at least, when I watched guys like Morikawa, when I watched guys like Justin Thomas, their game was so good getting to the green that I'm not sure all of these adjustments are really going to throw them off entirely too much. But if you guys, by the way, back in the studio, if you could throw up the odds really quickly, because I don't have them in front of me, just for the overall tournament, because the last time I looked, I'm like, Morikawa, you saw this adjustment too with his odds, right? Remember, he had won over the weekend at about 35-1. He is now near the top if you looked at some of his odds. Yeah, right. You're seeing this right now. What is it? DraftKings at 22-1. This is a guy who was 35-1 last weekend, right? You look at Justin Thomas, who last weekend was a range of 10-1. Now he's sitting at plus 950. So you're seeing the adjustment in the odds. And I wonder how much this is going to affect a lot of these guys. And then you have the guys at the top, right? Bryson DeChambeau, as we've talked about, the guy who has really changed his game and has been a driving menace. But in a course that is a little bit more important in terms of the iron play, how does he fare? Right, he can only grip it and rip it for, you know, I'd say a handful of these holes. But after that, it's about how you get to the greens in regulation and how much it's going to help you. Now, I'll say that there are, I think, two or three holes in which he'll be able to drive like a par four and be able to get in there. But regardless, I am fascinated by what this tournament is going to bring this weekend. All right, when we come back, we're going to take a look at UFC Fight Night. First, right now, just the two fights at the top of the card. I got some details on those. It's an interesting, interesting fight at the top between Ige and Cater. But we'll talk about that, the co-main event as well, and a few more as we head on through here on The Edge on VSiN, the sports betting network. And remember, Wes Reynolds joins us later in the show. All right, welcome back into The Edge here on VSiN, the sports betting network. Your reminder, VSiN Plus subs free until a major sport returns. Check that out, VSiN.com/subscribe. Tomorrow's Wednesday. It's hump day, which means that, of course, Point Spread Weekly will be live at 10 a.m. Pacific time. Did you guys know, apparently, I'm saying did you guys know. I realize that the staff back at VSiN Studios can hear me and everybody watching on VSiN.com. Today is apparently National Nude Day, so let it all hang out. Have a little fun today. Okay. UFC Fight Night. It is, I think, going to be a very fun main event. It looks like, actually, overall, a pretty quality card for a fight night. I think, really, like, the top three fights will look pretty good, and maybe there's some value that we can find. I haven't been able to get to the entire card as a whole in terms of studying on it, but I'll start with the main event and we'll work our way around here in the next few minutes. But Calvin Kattar is going to take on Dan Ige. Featherweight bout, a good one too, considering that these two guys are climbing their way up the rankings in the featherweight division. Sixth for Kattar. Ige comes in at 10th. So there's a couple of things that really stick out to me when I looked at this. The first of which is I merely thought Kattar should be favored. But then I saw the price at which it opened up, and I thought, I don't know if he should be favored by that much. Kattar right now opened up at about minus 300, sitting right now at minus 310. So it's moved about 10 cents in the last, I'd say, 12 hours or so, maybe even a little bit less. But again, like, this is the habit I'm trying to get myself into, at least. When you're talking about minus 300, right, the initial thought is, wow, that's a lot of money to lay. But also think about it in the perspective of implied probability. When you're looking at a price tag of minus 300, you're talking about this price is telling you that 75% of the time, Calvin Kattar is going to win this fight, or, you know, 75% chance that he is going to win this fight. I'm not sure if that's it shouldn't be that high. Kattar's a really solid striker to the eye test. And this is the other thing that I find really interesting about this fight. So we can throw up, you're watching VSiN.com. You see our tail of the tape, or advanced metric tail of the tape. So I mentioned that Calvin Kattar's a really good striker, and he is. Like, when you watch him, the combinations are absolutely fantastic. If you go back to some of the finishes that he's got out there, Jeremy Stevens, two-piece, no biscuit. Ricardo Lamas just destroyed him with a left hook and a straight right. Fishgold as well, two strikes, and then he put him down on the mat. But you look at the net significant strike differential for Calvin Kattar, it's a minus 1.17. So again, you're just looking at that. He's absorbing about 1.2 more significant strikes per minute than his opponents, absorbing more. You know, that's not exactly great. And he's got this process, at least, you know, I watched six of his fights last night, right? He seems to have this process of really feeling his opponent out before he starts to work into his groove, right? He did it against Jeremy Stevens. I thought arguably he lost the first rounds against Jeremy Stevens, but in the second round, finished him and ended up, you know, cutting his head open with an elbow, and that one was over. But you look at his process, and there's a certain point where you look and you say, yeah, he gets off to some slow starts. This is a beat fight, which he lost. I thought he maybe won the last two rounds. He for sure won the last one, but the first one, didn't think there was a question that he lost because he uses it to feel his opponent out. So maybe that plays a little bit into the significant striking numbers when you see that for Calvin Kattar, but you also see what kind of a fighter he wants to be, right? We talked about takedown average, the amount of takedowns that fighter will land every 15 minutes. He's under a half. Calvin Kattar's not going to try to take you down. He wants to stand up with you, and he's got a relatively solid takedown defense at 77%. Dan Ige is an interesting opponent because in terms of the significant strike differential, right, 0.99. So he's essentially landing one more significant strike per minute than his opponents up to this point. The takedown average is what's going to be pretty interesting because Calvin Kattar, from a takedown defense standpoint, is relatively solid. Ige can get you down. He lands about 2.15 successful takedowns every 15 minutes, right? His takedown defense is not great at 61%, but watching him overall in the few fights that I've studied of Dan Ige, you know, he is kind of a power puncher. He has the ability to go ahead and get on the floor and grind you down and do what he wants, right? But at the same time, if you looked at like the last few fights that he has fought, he comes out the Mirsad Bektic fight in the first round, throwing some really heavy fists early on and winning the first round. He got grounded to a pulp by Bektic in the second round, but again, he came back in the third round and the stand-up game really helped him. And this is the one thing that I'm wondering, because the one comparison, and maybe we'll have to ask people that are smarter in mixed martial arts than I am, but the comparison that I thought, at least for an opponent for Kattar, that was similar to Ige, at least in terms of the ferocity at which he fought with, was Chris Fishgold. And if you go back to watch that fight, Fishgold came out and he was just throwing as hard as he could. He was sending out flurries. He was trying everything possible. It seemed like to finish the round, the fight early, but ultimately he doesn't. And Kattar ends up finishing him within the first, it's a 4-minute mark of that fight. So if Ige does that here, can Calvin Kattar finish him? I'm not entirely sure if he can finish him. And this is where it gets to the interesting part about playing this, right? We talked about offsetting favorites, you know, big prices with some of these odds. Calvin Kattar to win via TKO is minus 115. You're laying a price for that to happen. And I'm not sure if that's the case, but you can get Kattar by decision over at DraftKings at plus 260. Be fascinated to see what that's going to look like once we get there. All right, plenty to get to here. When we come back, we'll have a little bit on the National Football League. Los Angeles Rams are up on deck, and then Wes Reynolds joins us in about 15. For the action, sign up for First Bet, a new betting and handicapping product from ExpressBet. Use a promo code Vegas500 to get a $10 free bet as soon as you sign up. Plus, receive up to $500 bonus for wagering in your first 30 days. Visit first.com/bet for more information. That's 1st.com/BET. Again, first.com/bet, promo code Vegas500. It is The Edge here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. I am your humble guide through this hour, Jonathan Von Tobel. I got to come up with a new line. I think I've used it a couple of times. Anyway, look at my book collection. That's pretty good, right? I feel like I buy these books to look smarter than I really am. Anyway, C Block means NFL team previews, Los Angeles Rams. I don't know why I read that to you. Yes, Los Angeles Rams are up today. So let's take a look, because I think the Rams are really, really, they're a team that Hags think has a really high ceiling and a really low floor. We'll put it that way. So Let's talk about this from the perspective of free agent additions. And you know, the way I kind of usually start the process is look at the offseason, right? Offseason losses and additions. And then you go from there. How did those losses and additions help or hurt their weaknesses and strengths from the year before? And where do you go from here? So really the notable free agent additions, they re-signed a few offensive linemen, right? But the notable free agent additions, the new additions to the team, Leonard Floyd, edge rusher, and A'shaun Robinson, defensive tackle, both coming from the NFC North. They, of course, get added to a front seven in the defensive line that was really a strength of this team last year, right? And that's really about it. But I wanted to talk about this offense, right? And we can tie into the draft and everything like that. So let's throw up the offensive numbers for the Los Angeles Rams. And the numbers that we're using here, you'll see them. These are courtesy of Football Outsiders. These are their DVOA metrics. So you see from an efficiency standpoint overall, the Rams offense just barely positive last year. They ended up ranking 17th in the National Football League in overall offensive efficiency. If you look at their pass offense, ended up ranking 13th in overall efficiency. The rush offense, 20th in the National Football League. And some of my favorite stats, right? The yards per drive and the points per drive gives you really an idea of how successful these offenses are. Yards per drive at that 32.17 mark, 17th in the National Football League for the Los Angeles Rams, and the points per drive 2.03, which, by the way, just because I was reading this yesterday and I just wanted to tell somebody, and my wife, I told, and she doesn't really care. The Ravens last year led the league in points per drive at 3.03. The Ravens averaged a bleeping field goal every single drive. That's how good their offense was. It's absolutely nuts. But anyway, I digress. So the offense for the Rams, two notable names on this side of the ball are gone, right? Brandon Cooks, Todd Gurley, but they could just be that names. Cooks totaled just 42 receptions last year, 583 yards, two touchdowns in 14 games, career lows in receptions and touchdowns, and just 33 yards ahead of his career low in terms of yardage, right? So he's out the door. Not sure if that's much of a loss considering how poor he had been from a statistical standpoint. Gurley posted a career low in rushing yards total, and of course his second lowest receiving yard total, 207, since his rookie season. On top of that, we know about the knee issues. They had to get rid of them. So on the surface, it's like, oh my God, we lost Brandon Cooks. Oh my God, Todd Gurley's not here anymore. But you look at what they did statistically, you realize that maybe it's not that much of a loss for the Rams. And then you look at this offense overall, right? It revolves around two key areas, the running game and Jared Goff. And yes, the quarterback, shocking. It revolves around him. But let's start with the running game because, and you know, actually they go hand in hand. So it's not even like I'm separating the two, and you'll see that in a second. In 2018, the Los Angeles Rams were one of the best play action offenses in the National Football League, if not the best. Goff saw an increase in yards per attempt of 2.5 yards whenever he used play action versus traditional drop back throws, right? He also led the league with 15 touchdown passes on play action throws. He was the only quarterback in the league that year to eclipse 2,000 yards passing when using play action. Last season, 2019, he goes from 2.5 yards additionally when using play action to just 1.1. He averaged 8.1 yards per attempt on play action passes. The running game has to be better if he is going to thrive, right? It goes hand in hand. Their rushing offense, you saw it right there, right? Finished 20th in terms of efficiency, generally not a successful facet of their offense. In more traditional metrics, they ranked 27th in terms of yards per attempt on the ground, 3.7. They ranked 26th in yards per game, 93.7. This is, again, an offense that needs to thrive with play action, ranking in the 20s in traditional rushing metrics. That's not something that's going to get it done if you're the Los Angeles Rams. So the question is, how do they get better, right? You got rid of Todd Gurley. You actually, and this is the other part that kind of worries me about the Los Angeles Rams, when I mean that they have a really high ceiling but a really low floor, right? Because their offensive line, let's take a look at that, for example, right, before we get to the running backs. Their offensive line was just the 19th ranked run blocking unit in the National Football League last year, and they retained a majority of it, right? Their offensive line averaged just 4.27 adjusted line yards per carry, according to Football Outsiders. Again, 19th in the National Football League. They were 18th in power/short yardage situations. They were 26th in percentage of rushing attempts stuffed behind the line of scrimmage, and they were 14th in second level yards, right? So they're at or in the bottom half, well into the bottom half, and a lot of these rushing metrics, if you look at their offensive line, which is generally back this year, and then you look at the replacements, right, for Todd Gurley and what this running back core is going to look like. Darrell Henderson last year, really limited action in 13 games. He averaged just 3.7 yards per attempt. It was just under 150 attempts overall, right? And they draft Cam Akers, which a lot of people project Cam Akers is probably going to be the guy in terms of the starting running back, probably fits a little bit better with what the Los Angeles Rams want to do. But can those two, Darrell Henderson and Cam Akers, rejuvenate a rushing offense behind that offensive line that can thus take the pressure off of Jared Goff? And look, this is on Goff himself as well. He ranked 18th among 34 qualified quarterbacks in DVOA. He threw, get this, remember I told you, he threw 15 play action touchdown passes in 2018. He threw four last year to five interceptions. So that's definitely got to get better on Goff's part. So this is why everything goes together. And by the way, he was also the 23rd ranked quarterback in passer rating on play action passes in 2019. So it all kind of goes together, right? The rushing offense, if it's performing well, play action is more deadly, but Goff also has to be accurate with those throws. So if we're looking at this offense overall, it's on Jared Goff in this rushing game to turn things around. And you have to wonder if Darrell Henderson and a guy like Cam Akers can do it. I personally think they kind of can. And here's the other part about it. I really like their defense overall. The issues with me on their defense is the names that they lost defensively are much more impactful than the names they lost on offense, right? Corey Littleton, for example, fantastic coverage linebacker. He's in Las Vegas. He graded out 79 overall, 82.3 in terms of coverage, not here anymore. Dante Fowler, 11 and a half sacks last year, was absolutely great. 75 against the run, 73.3 as a pass rusher, according to PFF. He's not here anymore. Eric Weddle, retired. Not the highest graded safety in the world, but John Johnson, Taylor, I don't know why I didn't type his last name, but essentially the safeties that they have now at this point are kind of like, I wouldn't say negatives, but general grading in the range of like 65, high 60s, low 70s, which is not the greatest. And I don't think either one of them at this point graded in the 70s last year. And then you look at overall. So we think the linebacking core is a little bit weaker. Their safeties are weaker as well, but you still have a really good front in terms of what Aaron Donald brings to the table and their three down linemen and the corners as well. Overall, no good read on the Los Angeles Rams, but I think when you look at them as a whole, really high ceiling, really low floor. I generally think this is about a 9-win team, but we'll have more on this as we get closer to the NFL season. Back to the Memorial on the other side when Wes Reynolds joins us next. VSiN Plus subs are free until a major sport returns. Check it out. You want to become a smarter better. You want to increase your betting IQ. You want to learn to bet like the pros. If you want to get expert betting strategies and maybe betting analysis for every sport, 24/7 video replays of every show, check out VSiN.com/subscribe. All right. Last couple of minutes here on the edge before we get out of here. Well, I'm not going to leave. My house is awesome. It's an apartment, not a house. Wes Reynolds, nice enough to give us a couple of minutes, give his much smarter perspective on what's going to happen in Dublin this weekend. The Memorial going down, the field is better, and Wes is here with us. Wes, thanks very much. So let's start with this, man. The changes over at the course. We were talking about this earlier in the show. Faster greens, longer rough, moved tee boxes and pin placements. How much do you take from what we watched over the weekend over to this weekend when it comes to the guys who performed very well, like Morikawa, like Thomas, and the other guys near the top of the leaderboard?
In terms of the statistical analysis, I guess, and what are the most pertinent metrics, JBT, it's really going to be similar. Strokes gained approach, strokes gained to green. It's still going to remain a second shot golf course, and that's what Jack Nicklaus has always wanted it designed to be at Muirfield Village. So I think from a stat standpoint, it's going to be the same. But as you mentioned, there are going to be some different nuances. The scoring has been low since we've come back with the restart just a few weeks ago. But I would expect probably the winning score is going to be more in the mid-teens instead of the high teens per se. So look, you're going to have slicker greens, as you said, 13 on the stint meter, arguably some of the fastest that these guys see on tour, very similar to Augusta National in that regard, where if you lose one, it's going to roll right off the green. And you see that oftentimes at the Masters. The rough is going to be about half inch to an inch thicker. So a lot of premiums in terms of putting this in the fairway. It's not necessarily a distance course, even though it's a little under 7,400 yards. but you've got to be a lot more straight than you have to be long here.
The three stats that I latched onto, Wes, from this last weekend and in what I'm looking for in golfers overall was driving accuracy, greens in regulation, and putts per green in regulation. Now, the thing with the putts per green in regulation, which I was kind of throwing around it, I wanted to bounce off of you, was if these greens are faster, right? Like a guy like Colin Morikawa, who had a really good number in terms of the putts per greens in regulation, how much is he thrown off by the fact that these greens are quicker? You know what I mean?
Right. I think some of the guys are going to have to adjust to this. And yep. Some guys putt better on faster greens than they putt on slower greens. And I mean, usually what we see is that a lot of the foreign players, especially the European players, are more often not better on slower greens. But I think it really is on an individual player, kind of a case by case basis. So there is going to be a little bit of an adjustment. And I don't think it's that much of an advantage that from the guys that played at the Workday Charity Open last week to the guys that had the week off. So I think it's kind of going to be a hodgepodge or a little bit of a mix of guys that played solid last week are going to do okay this week, and guys that had the week off are going to be up there. I don't think it's just going to be all guys that played at the Workday that are going to be on the leaderboard come Sunday, and the guys that had the week off are at a total disadvantage. I don't see that at all.
So let's get to some individual golfers. First off, the most popular name everybody wants to know about. Tiger is going to be back, open at the Westgate at 25-1. Course history is absolutely very fantastic for a guy like Tiger Woods. Hasn't played for a while, so I was making a case at the top. Maybe the rust for Tiger holds him back from winning, but I don't necessarily think it holds him back from like a top 20 finish. What do you think out of Tiger this weekend? What are we going to see?
Yeah, I think you're spot on there, JBT. I think that's exactly what we're going to see. He's not going to play poorly. And if there is a place other than maybe Bay Hill for the Arnold Palmer Invitational in Orlando, if there's a place where he can come off the shelf and contend, it would be here at Muirfield Village, where he's won five times. But you look at the strength of the field, JBT, you got 57 of the top 64 players in the official world golf rankings. This is one of the better fields. This is a major championship type of field. So to be able to come off the rack, basically, and he hasn't played what I would call a semi-competitive event. He played that in May for the match down in Jupiter, Florida with TB12, Peyton Manning, and Phil Mickelson. But he hasn't played a tournament since Riviera, which was in early February. So it might be a big ask for asking him to win. I know there's some people that like him this week because they see the price, because we don't get Tiger Woods at 25-1. And really, he probably, you could argue, should be a bigger price, should be in like the 33 or 35-1 range. Now, no bookmaker is going to be stupid enough to put him at that because he's going to get action at 25-1. So why the heck would you put him in the 30s? But I think you're accurate there with where he's going to finish. I could see him top 20, second, third page of the leaderboard.
Two golfers really stood out to me when I was going through a lot of these numbers. We'll start with Ricky Fowler. So last week, tied for 22nd, was 8-under. The one thing, this is the thing that intrigues me about him, Wes, is so not only he's in the range, I think he's 40-1, 50-1 in that range. But the thing with Ricky Fowler was, out of all of his numbers, right, like we were going over this earlier, tied for 7th in the tournament over the weekend in driving accuracy, tied for 14th in putts per green in regulation. But he only hit 62.5% of his greens in regulation, which is going to be a massive thing if that's going to hold him back. What'd you make of Ricky over the weekend and his chances coming up this weekend at about 40-50-1?
I didn't play him this week, JBT, but I think he could certainly go well here. He's got very good history, despite the fact that he's never won here. He's got a couple runner-ups in 2010 and 2017, was 8th in 2018. His form is getting a little bit better. He finished a respectable 12th. I really like the way he played in Detroit and almost considered him last week and got up there, just didn't make a move on Sunday and was very stationary and ended up 22nd. I thought he played a little bit better than his finish, but just didn't make anything on Sunday. And like you said, with the greens and whatnot, he needs to do better to score lower. But I certainly could make a case for Ricky. I didn't play him this week, but I think he's starting to show a little bit of progress. So maybe you won't see it this week, but as we go along in the season, I would expect you're going to see much higher finishes from Fowler.
The other one that stuck out, he's a long shot. And last weekend, he was 300-1 and ended up finishing tied for 17th. This weekend, he's 125-1. What am I missing with Rory Sabatini that these numbers are still in the triple digits with him? He's playing in recent form, like since the hiatus, Wes. He's played really well. He's got some solid course numbers here. He played really well last weekend. What is it with Rory Sabatini that I'm kind of missing? Because I find it kind of surprising. Like, I don't expect him to be in like the 40-1 range, but these are back-to-back tournaments in triple digits on a course that he does relatively well on.
Yeah, and he's somebody I looked at as well, JBT, and he's got a runner-up on this course. Now, it's back in like 2012, but yeah. He's been playing solid, and especially if you're a DFS player, if you're a DraftKings player, this would be a guy at a lower salary that I think should certainly show up on the leaderboard, where you don't have to necessarily pick him to win. Now, if you choose a bet option, maybe a top 10 or a top 20 type of option. But Sabatini's an interesting case because this was supposed to be the Olympic year, and he is married to a Slovakian woman. We know that Rory Sabatini is from South Africa, but he was supposed to represent Slovakia because he really wanted to play in the Olympics. So he has dual citizenship now in that country. But all of a sudden now, the Olympics being canceled due to the pandemic, he's not going to get that chance. So this was a year where you thought he would really be motivated and play well. And look, three finishes in the top 25 in his last four events. There are certainly worse triple-digit bombs to look at than Rory Sabatini.
Any golfers that we should be looking at in terms of either fading or staying completely away from in a course like this?
Yeah, when I was looking through maybe some guys I wanted to avoid, it's not really necessarily on course form, but it was more kind of recent form. I think Jordan Spieth's play has been too erratic, really, to back him, even though he's got two top seven finishes here in the last 5 years. And there's the obvious parallels from Muirfield Village to Augusta. But I just find it very hard to trust him. He still has the same problems. He's not accurate enough off the tee. He misses too many fairways. And if you do that in the thick stuff, as great of a scrambler and as great of a putter as he is, he's going to have to make long putts to save par instead of making birdies.
Yeah, he's about 65-1, depending on where you look. The other name that stuck out to me, and this is, I think Humans put it really well when I talked to him the other day. If I wouldn't say every tournament, West, but if there's most tournaments where I'm getting a guy like Xander Schauffele at 30-1 with his game, which is so well-rounded, and I trust him with second shot opportunities, like, I'll take Xander Schauffele at 30-1.
Yeah, I didn't take him this week. I had already bet him a few weeks ago for the PGA Championship at 25-1. Okay. Search around, maybe you can find a better number. But that was kind of the spot I pinpointed for him where I thought he was really going to get right. He's a California guy, albeit based in San Diego, and the PGA in a few weeks is in Northern California in San Francisco. But he's a guy that's gone well at these majors, and I think he's more he just has the game of like a PGA champion, a guy that can really get hot with the putter and make a lot of birdies in a row and post a low score. So I didn't use him this week. I can never argue against him. And look, we know our buddy Matt Humans is the biggest Xander Schauffele stan at VSiN. He'll find a way to play him most weeks. And I was surprised if he didn't make his card this week. But yeah, Schauffele is a guy I think to keep an eye on as he kind of rounds his game into form. And I think he could be very dangerous at the PGA in a couple weeks.
All right, Wes, what's coming up on Long Shots this week?
Yeah, we're going to be talking Memorial, Brady Cannon and I, with our guest David Bierman from ESPN Chalk, and reviewing a little bit of the workday and then previewing the tournament this week and see if we can find a winner and see if Brady can break his runner-up streak. 2 weeks in a row, he's had the second-place finisher on the futures board.
Hopefully he can. All right, but hey, thanks for coming on with us. Always appreciate it. Have a good show, okay?
All right, thanks, JBT. Always good to be with you.
You got it. Wes Reynolds again at Wes Reynolds one up on Twitter. Don't want to spoil it because I'm sure they'll give him away on Long Shots. You can check out his Twitter account. I posted up some plays earlier today. Make sure you watch Long Shots because it is by far, and this is factual, the best golf handicapping show in the universe here on VSiN and VSiN.com. With that, VSiN.com/podcast. You missed out on any part of the show. Edge will be back tomorrow. We'll see you.